Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is Director of IT and 9to5 Mac contributor, Bradley Chambers. Bradley, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be on the show.
I'm glad to have you on the show because of your background and your expertise. I can't wait to get into this. For the listeners, Bradley has been managing Apple devices in an educational environment since 2009. And through your experience deploying and managing hundreds of Macs and iPads, you have a deep understanding which Apple products work and ways Apple could improve its products. Yay.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, might make sense to someone with one iPhone or one iPad or one Mac. But when you start thinking in triple digits, there are just different ways you have to manage them. And, you know, things that, they're just different in terms of how they scale up. So, yeah, it's a fun discussion and looking forward to getting into it.
You're also a contributor 9to5 Mac, and that's where I found out about you and your article column called Making the Grade, which is cool.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have that goes up every Saturday. It's just an Apple education focused article. A lot of it's it's not so much focused on news, but more of a lot of it's opinion, and it's just things I'm working on and things I'm thinking about. So yeah, it goes up every Saturday at 9 Eastern.
Okay, well, so we'll get into it in a second. I want to thank Molecule Air Purifier for being our ad this week, and we'll talk about Molecule more at the midpoint of the show. So I know you have expertise at a school and IT management, as you said, but as we do on Background Mode, tell me about your early years, how you got into computers in the first place.
Well, I've always kind of been into computers. It's been a hobby of mine. My dad was into them when I was growing up. I remember, DOS-based operating systems, and probably the first game I ever played on a computer was Classic Concentration. So if anybody's been around the computers since the late 80s, early 90s, you certainly probably remember that game. We had two computers, obviously desktop, linked together via LAN, and I was playing Quake 1 on, I had to have been in second or third grade.
Oh, pretty high tech.
Yeah, I mean, so I've obviously just always been into computers, and then I didn't go to school for computers. My undergrad is in business, and I was working at a telephone company. They did internet and TV and things like that. So when I say telephone, it's not just a telephone company; it's an independent company in Northwest Georgia, and because Chattanooga, Tennessee, is right on the line of Northwest Georgia and Tennessee, so that's where I'm from. So you've kind of always been into computers. Got my first Mac in 2005. Somebody that I worked with, that telephone company, had a 12-inch PowerBook G4, and I really liked that computer. And he started showing me, Mac OS, and it was obviously Panther at the time. And he really kind of liked it. And so I ended up selling my Windows computer and getting that. So that was my first Mac, and honestly, might still be my favorite Mac. I mean, obviously, compared to this new Mac today, no. But at the time, gosh, that was a great computer. It was thin, it was reliable. I love that computer. So yeah, that was kind of how I got into Mac, and which obviously I'm really appreciative to that guy because that's all I do now. And yeah, literally a guy I work with, his name was Doug McNish. So if anybody in Chattanooga knows a guy named Doug McNish, I kind of owe this part of my career to him. And so didn't really envision getting into IT, kind of just fell into it. School needed someone. I mean, obviously I knew a lot about it. But then also really understood the Apple world as well. I mean, I think this was really pre-iPad as well when I started getting into this. And so much of what I do now, I couldn't have learned in school. And that's what I always tell people about IT is IT is just constant learning because, you go to school for something, gosh, it can change. I mean, all things are that way. You go to school for programming. Well, gosh, 20 years later, it's different. You've got to stay on the ball.
How did you get that job? Having a background in business and computers is great, but normally people either aspire to become an IT manager or they get sucked into it by accident.
It's kind of by accident. In some ways, I always say life's about who you know, not about what you know. And they took a chance on me. I was kind of looking for a little bit of a change, and it was just the right place at the right time. And it worked out for all. I obviously learned a lot on the job. But again, I mean, so much of what I do now, I couldn't have known then. I mean, things have just changed so much in the last decade with technology that no one could have learned it. And I mean, there's just things I deal with today that, a good example is we have like an after school care management system that I manage. Well, I mean, that's not something you learn in college, but like learning how to deploy new solutions and to manage them and get them up and running, how to evaluate them, that just kind of, you just kind of pick it up.
Tell me about your school. How big is it, and what role do you play? Are you, as an IT manager, do you have a hand in the selection of equipment and purchasing as well?
Yeah, so we're in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Like I said, we're a K-5 school. So Chattanooga is kind of set up with, there's a lot of K-5 schools. There's a couple K-12 schools, and then there's a lot of 6-12 schools. So we feed into schools like McCauley, Baylor, and Girls Preparatory School. Those are three of like the major prep schools in the area. McCauley, as a good example, is where Ted Turner went to school. And then we also feed into the other high schools as well. And we really consider ourselves to be academically strong. I mean, a couple years ago, of the six high schools in our area, four of the Valley Victorians were graduates of our school. And I can think of no better, kind of advertising for your school than that, because it's like clearly they're doing well in school. But Chattanooga is unique as well that we're one of the highest percent of kids in private school as anywhere in the country. We have roughly 44,000 students in Chattanooga in public school and 10,000 in private. And that really puts us in the top 5% in the country, which is random. You wouldn't think Chattanooga, Tennessee. But again, part of it is just that legacy of these schools have been around for, 80, 90 years. And, my granddaddy went to McCauley, so I'm going to McCauley. My daddy went to McCauley, et cetera, et cetera. So we have about 300 students. We have a 3-year-old kindergarten all the way to fifth grade. In my role, I like to say it's like director of taking care of business is what probably my title should be, because obviously I do a lot with technology. I teach a coding class, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I want to ask you about that. Let's get to that soon.
But then I also like work with our parents on admissions and enrollment. Like I manage our enrollment system in terms of like how it works. And so I do a lot. I do a lot with like just back end operations. I meet with parents about, if they're needing help with stuff. I mean, my parents walk in my office. It's not like I'm in the back of the building in the boiler room and nobody ever sees me. I mean, I'm here in the front. Yeah. And parents walk in and talk to me, and that's just really what makes our school great is we're very, very accessible. I mean, probably, 100 of the parents we have my cell phone, which is fine. That's the kind of school we are. And
kids don't have phones, do they?
No, kids don't. Well, some of them do, oddly enough. That's just, I think, makes our school great is just the openness. It's a family atmosphere. I mean, it's like, it's just people have, if somebody wants to meet with the headmaster, on Monday morning, they'll likely get a meeting with him. And that's not the case at all the schools around the country. I mean, we just have a headmaster who's very available, and that just the attitude permeates down. It's part of our culture that, we're here to serve our parents. I mean, they're paying for something they can get for free elsewhere. And you certainly don't treat it like it's a battery store, but where the customer's always right. But like we want to, if we take our tuition divided by the number of days, you want to ask your parents, did they get that value today? And that's something we just really strive for.
Speaking about paying parents, I assume that you have enough money in the budget to buy the equipment you need. I hear about so many school administrators and IT managers who are strapped for funds. They can't afford Macintoshes anymore, and they end up falling into Chromebooks, and they're just strapped for cash. But how is the situation in your school?
Well, we own the devices. We do a lease with Apple, so we buy new gear every 3 to 4 years, and so that's how we do it. I mean, obviously, our school has fundraisers. I mean, 85% of our tuition is revenue, or 85% of our revenue is tuition. Then 85% of our expenses are human resources related with people. And so you do, we have fundraisers, but we don't have like a technology fee. I know a lot of schools do that. We don't have that. The thing about money, and I know all schools, I know there are certainly small schools that just literally they don't have the resources to buy technology, let's just throw out like public schools. Money is not the issue. Public schools. It's just not, because a lot of public school, and then again, I know there could be exceptions, but like your average school district, they find the money for the things they want to do, whether it's new football stadium, new lights for this. I mean, the money I don't think it's a problem in the developed world. I think it's about priorities. And for whatever reason, like if a school, has aging technology, it's not a priority for them because it's like it's hard to have like a brand new football stadium or a brand new softball field or a brand new X or brand new floors and then say, well, technology is falling the wayside. Well, it's not a priority. And that's not wrong. It's not bad. It's just, it's not, you see what I'm getting at? Like, it's it's about what your priorities are.
Because you're focused on K through five, you don't have to worry about a big time football team.
Well, and not even necessarily that. It's even a school that is K-12, you just have to decide, decide where your resources are going. And if technology is, you can't say technology is an important aspect of our school and then not spend money on it.
Do you have a mix of Macintoshes and iPads? And why?
We do. All of our teachers still have laptop, MacBooks, MacBook Air, sorry. And then all the students use iPads. There's just things that are for what a teacher does. They're just easier on a laptop. Good example is there's still aspects of printing that's just easier on a computer in terms of being able to set different parameters on the printing. I love an iPad, but I'm still faster on a Mac than I am an iPad. But again, the iPad's still a great device, and I think for certainly what students are using, they are just a dream device.
Do you give the iPads to the students to take home and do homework on, or do you issue them every morning?
No, everything stays here, and I think that's a trend of a lot of schools is they don't start going home until middle school. It's just when you start taking devices home, there's just a whole other set of problems, and I don't think they really need to consider that until they roll into middle school.
Yeah, not to mention getting lost or stolen or broken or damaged or whatever. Yeah. So what happens if you have an iPad break, if one of your students accidentally drops an iPad? Can you repair it there or do you have to send it out?
I don't repair them here. I mean, I could do some Mac repairs. I've got my Mac hardware certification, but honestly, the way Apple's kind of lineup is, it's more expensive to repair them in-house. And so, for example, let's say I have a MacBook Air that, screen breaks. Well, I can buy that screen from Apple for $410. Or I can send it off to Apple and they can repair for $400. It's like, I'll let them do it for that. We've got spares. So if a teacher breaks a laptop accidentally, I can just hand it out with an iPad. Same thing. We can, it's just easier to swap them. Now with iPads, they're not... It's tough on the repairs. We've had some stuff done, like kind of aftermarket repairs with some local companies that have worked well. But like Apple's repairs on a $300 iPad are $250. I mean, why am I going to pay that? I'll just buy a new one. And so, things happen. We don't have a lot break, but certainly things do happen. It's usually accidental. I think the key is to set up guidelines on what happens if it's intentional damage. And again, this goes back to if students are taking them home. Especially, if a student breaks something at home and it looks like a car ran over it. I mean, should the school pay for that? I mean, I don't know. Every school is different, but the key is to have it kind of your guidelines set to what happens, if a student breaks a device.
How do you handle account management on the iPads? Is there, because each iPad has to have an Apple ID, is there a Scholastic management tool that allows you to have multiple students log on with their Touch ID on the home button, or how do you do that?
So our main identity management solution is in Google Apps. So our students that have accounts that's kind of their identity system. So they're not using Pages for documents; they're using Google Docs, and that's where you can kind of log into their account. For Apple IDs, everything is done through what's called device-based app assignment. So none of our iPads have actual Apple IDs logged in. I can push apps remotely from our management system that just get assigned to the device, and I can revoke those and delete them anytime. I mean, again, if a teacher gave me an app and said, put this on, 200 iPads, I can do that in 5 minutes. It's not a big deal. Apple has a portal called the Volume Purchase Portal. I can buy apps through there in bulk.
So any student can pick up an iPad off the cart and just log on and start using it?
They can, yeah. Now there's another program, too, called Shared iPad. where students can have their kind of own individual setup on an iPad, but they can then, you know, share it with others. We don't use that. It's another thing to set up and manage. Most of our kind of identity management is through, you know, Google's G Suite. But again, I can push apps remotely without a student having to accept the terms and conditions. It just literally appears.
Cool. Let's talk about coding. One of the things I've noticed via my spouse is that Colorado schools are a little bit backwards in teaching kids coding, even in high school. And you mentioned that you start to get into coding a little bit at your grade levels. Tell me about that.
I think the fundamental value of coding is not that every kid's going to be a programmer. Is it teaches problem solving. And I think that's a problem with students nowadays and even adults that we don't want to troubleshoot. We want to be able to watch a YouTube video and figure something out. We want to just hire a repairman, which I do that, you know, and that's what I was talking to my dad one day. We were fixing my fridge and he said, you know, the biggest difference in you're in my generation is you could, you know, go on YouTube for stuff. Like, you know, I had to figure it out. And students are that way. They don't like, there's a big difference between I don't understand and I don't know. And I think a lot of students nowadays think that I don't know it means I don't understand it. And my point is always, you haven't tried. And so I think that's the value of coding, is it forces them to slow down and figure stuff out. And so I teach a coding class once a year for a quarter of the school year, and I use Swift Playgrounds on the iPad. And it is not easy. It is difficult. But the thing I always tell them to do is look, if it takes you the whole class to get through this one little problem, that's okay. It's not about finishing. It's about doing it right and learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's real value to the iPad that Swift Playgrounds is free. I mean, if you look at what coding curriculum can cost, it cannot, you know, it costs money. Well, it's just free with purchase of the iPad. So there's real value there.
All right. Well, I think we're going to have to close out for a segment. It's time for a commercial break. Folks, I'm chatting with Bradley Chambers. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Hi, this is John Martellaro with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Molecule. Molecule is a complete reinvention of the air purifier, not just an improvement on existing outdated technology. It was developed by a scientist whose son suffered from asthma and who was frustrated by the fact that HEPA air filters did not relieve his son's symptoms. Molecule introduces a breakthrough science that is finally capable of destroying air pollutants at a molecular level. Molecule's PICO technology goes beyond HEPA filtration, which is an old technology, to not just capture but completely destroy the full spectrum of indoor air pollutants, including those 1,000 times smaller than HEPA filter can trap, that is, 0.3 microns. The results have transformed lifelong allergy and asthma sufferers' lives. One customer even said that she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. Molecule's technology has been personally effective and verified by science, but most importantly, it's been tested by real people. Molecule has already helped allergy and asthma sufferers around the country better cope with their conditions and significantly reduce their symptoms. And now Molecule has a special offer for BGM listeners. Visit MOLEKULE.com and save $75 off your first order. At checkout, just use promo code BGM. So thanks, Molecule, for being our sponsor. And we're back. I'm chatting with Bradley Chambers, an IT director at a small school in Tennessee and a contributor to 9to5 Mac. So let's continue on with this fascinating discussion. Have you guys ever used Chromebooks, ever been tempted? Are they part of your curriculum?
I've got 10 Chrome, they call them boxes. They're the desktop version in our library. They're used just for quick research and things like that. They're great devices. I don't think it should be an either or. I think it could be an and. And I think what schools have to consider is, what are your goals? Like, what are your goals with technology? And then you then find the device that helps you meet those goals. Because there's things that the iPad does better than the Chromebook and the Mac, et cetera, et cetera. But you've just got to define your goals as an institution.
I have had several discussions with school technical people who say that even at an early age, it's good to get the kids typing on a real keyboard. And there are some pedagogical tools that involve keyboard interaction and screen displays and apps that are just not available on the iPads. But at your level, that may not be a problem because of the kinds of things that you're teaching. So do you find that the iPads are completely capable of doing everything you need to do at your grade level?
I do. And if typing is a concern, there's an app called Tap Typing that is really inexpensive and works great. And you can plug up an external keyboard to the iPad.
Do you do that?
We do. We don't use the keyboards all the time, but when it makes sense, we'll bring them out and use them. Would I argue keyboarding is as essential today as it was 20 years ago? No, but I do see how there's still value in it.
One of the things that you have in your intro is that you are a keen observer of Apple and education and what they might be doing to help out. I've seen more complaints than success stories. It could be just bad news, you know, trumping the good news. But do you have any thoughts about what you think Apple should be doing that they're not doing in education?
Their biggest weakness is the lack of an identity management system in terms of they need a tool like G Suite from Google that like is email, it's documents, it's calendars, all that rolled into one. The problem now is if a school wants to go all in on Apple, they can't. From end to end, in terms of like software and hardware, but you can with Google, and so you can be an all iPad school, but you probably still have either Exchange 365 or G Suite, and so that's their biggest issue in the short term. But I do think long term that makes it a heck of a lot easier to deploy Chromebooks, because if you're already using that for your identity management system, there's nothing really to do. You just roll them out. And so that's their biggest problem. Now, they do a lot of great things. So I think it's like the trendy thing to just complain. That's fine. That's what people do. But Apple still has a lot of really good stories to tell. But I think there's some operational stuff that schools need help with that I think they need to address.
I see a lot of complaints about not having multiple accounts on iPads. Does that derive from the misunderstanding about how schools manage the identity on schools, like you were saying in the first segment, that you don't really need to have multiple Unix-like account logins for students because of the way you guys are able to manage the iPads? It's a non-issue.
No, we don't. But that feature is there. That feature's been there for about 2 years, I think. It's called Shared iPad. Now, it's not available to anybody like a home user, but Shared iPad is available to schools where you can, students can have individual passcodes, and you can have four or five students logging in the same device and having their own. Yeah, that's a thing. But the problem is it's a whole other system to set up, and there's some deployment models that need to be tightened up there.
Okay, very good. Well, we got to move on. We don't have a whole lot of time left. And in the time left, I want to ask you about your weekly column. You write a column for 9to5Mac called Making the Grade. Tell me about what you have explored there and what topics give you the most feedback.
Topics that give me the most feedback are things around, like I said, just the high level deployment of Apple in education. Because, again, I think we all know that the success of the iPad and the great things the iPad can do, but there's still just like go-to-market type things that schools need help with. And those get the most feedback. And then, what topics have I explored? I've just looked at a gamut. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It's just kind of whatever I'm thinking about. Maybe it's something it's affecting me in school that week. One of the things I'm working on right now is kind of my software update strategy for iOS and macOS. I mean, again, if you're a home user, you deploy iOS 12 day one, there's a little bug, even if it's not an Apple bug, but a bug in one of your apps, who cares? Well, they'll fix it. But if I push out iOS 12 on day one and there's a bug in one of our key apps, well, that's a problem. It's a problem for a lot of people, and there's no good way to go back. So I actually have the ability to delay updates for 90 days, which I will be doing on iOS. So like on all of our iPads that I manage, they can do software update. They won't see anything.
Is that a feature of your identity management system that allows you to block out and delay iOS updates?
Yeah, it's through our mobile device management system, which is Jamf Pro, J-A-M-F Pro.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of our sponsors over on Jeff Gamet's TMO Daily Observations podcast.
But
we love Jamf.
Yeah, Jamf is amazing. But this API is from Apple. So it's something that Jamf has incorporated that Apple has built in. And so, I'll delay the update for 90 days. That'll probably get us onto iOS 12.0.1 at least, if not 12.0.2. And so I'll go straight to that. And then I'll give our key apps time to make sure they're updated. And so, yeah, that's something I'm kind of looking at right now because that's something I'm thinking about.
You wrote a recent column that really caught my attention because it's a subject dear to my heart. The title was Digital Textbooks for the iPad Never Took Off, and Here's Why. The background on that is that my wife is an educator, and there was a time when the iPads first came out when we had this glorious vision, or at least I did, or we did, or some of us on the TMO staff, of a glorious vision of digital textbooks. You have one iPad you carried around in your backpack, and you got all the textbooks you need, and they're in digital form, and everything's cool. But things didn't go that way for various reasons. Technology, the proper display, the choice of display format and textbooks, and publisher concerns and finances. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it's just a couple things. So again, I was in the same boat that you are in terms of, oh, this would be great. We can get rid of the heavy books. And then what I've realized over time is I think maybe an okay thing that we didn't delegate the iPad to just being a digital book reader. It can be so much more. The one issue you have is, you've got these, four or five major textbook companies. A couple of the big states buy books at the state level. And it's just a control issue. And this is nothing that Amazon has a good solution for. There's nothing Apple has a good solution for. There's just no way to do digital textbooks on the iPad. Now, so what has happened is some of our books, our math book, for example, it comes with a digital component, which is a whole other system I have to set up, individual user accounts for every student and teachers. And then they can log in on the web and or an app and access their math book digitally. But it only comes with it if we buy the physical book. So that's kind of how the market's rolled out. But again, it's just this, Apple's strategy originally was they're going to sell low-cost books to the iBook store. But the problem with that is, unlike apps, once you assign, you can only assign books to an Apple ID. You can't assign them to a device. So when I assign apps to a device, I can revoke them and get that license back. So if I only have a specialized application we only need for various points on certain iPads, I can pick it up and go and move it to different spots. But with books, once you assign it to an Apple ID, it's gone. And well, obviously the student doesn't need the book the next year, but I do. And so I have to keep rebuying them. And it quickly becomes where the digital books are more expensive.
Yeah, I get the feeling that it's all about control, about digital rights management, and about securing cash flow by publishers. My wife's students are still faced with the prospect of paying $100 or more in some cases for programming books and paper because of the way things work. Even when they try to buy a used book, they're pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's all about money. I think at the end of the day, it's all about money.
Yeah, and it's also human ergonomics too. You have display formats that sort of screw around with the layout that was in the book, depending on how the format goes. And the ability to do stickies and highlights and scribble in notes and to randomly access pages and flip through. I always thought there was a human factor in touching and holding and writing in a physical paper book that just isn't part of the iPad experience. What do you think?
I think there's real value in reading a physical book. And I think there's real value in writing as well. I think it's a mixture. I would love to have the option for certain books to be on the iPad, but maybe not others. But yeah, I think there's still value in paper products.
Yeah. You wrote another article at 9to5 Mac called Let's Move Past the iPad versus Mac and Look at the Future. You had some interesting thoughts in that article.
Yeah. It's like, I really just want one device in my life, but with ability to become multiple devices. So like, I want a phone that I can come in and dock to a 27-inch monitor at work. Because I mean, our phones and iPads are really powerful. I mean, these A chips are really powerful. It's got great networking support in there. They're great devices, but I'm tired of carrying around like multiple devices. It's like, I would love to have just like a phone-like thing. And be able to just to take it home, maybe put it into the iPad format, take it to work, put it into almost a desktop type format, and then just all my data lives in iCloud, and I don't have to keep buying and supporting multiple devices.
Think Apple would like that because buying and supporting multiple devices is exactly what they want.
Well, but if you only had to buy one device, would you be willing to pay $1,500, $2,000 for it every couple of years? I might. I mean, it's, you know, you look at what you'd be willing to pay for something that can combine multiple devices. And that's exactly what the iPhone did, is it combined all these devices into one, and you're willing to pay more for it.
Yeah, but I'm sitting here on an Macintosh Pro from 2013, and if you look at the back, it's got a rat's nest of wires. I've got a Time Machine drive. I've got this USB mic. I've got an SSD for carbon copy cloner. I've got a hub for various devices and keyboards and mice and flash drives and charging docks and micro USB connector for charging devices. And so, you know, you'd have to have a pretty sophisticated dock for a phone that was going to be your entire computing life.
Well, I mean, I know certainly, like, you know, the high-end pro configuration, certainly. But you think about, like, the 12-inch, you know, or the MacBook Air, for example, or the 12-inch MacBook. How much faster is that than a phone? I don't know if any anymore.
It's in terms probably of just, not.
Right. In terms, and so it's really about rethinking what these devices look like. So, yeah, just I'd love to me, that's kind of looking at the future, and what I would like to have is just one device to rule them all.
That would be cool, but, you know, somehow I suspect that it doesn't fit into Apple's financial picture for the device, the multiple devices they want to sell us in our lives. I just have a sneaking suspicion. Have you been doing any work with iBooks Author? I've heard that there's been a lack of interest by Apple in iBooks Author, and it's kind of fading. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a cool application, but it's nowhere. It's how much better is it than when it launched? Not that much. You still can't build, you know, Pages on the iPad has some of the features now, but not all of them. It's a dead platform.
Okay, that's what I've been hearing too. Thanks for the confirmation. All right, well, we've come to the end of our allotted time. Are there any other topics? Oh, I wanted to ask you one more thing. What's your favorite go-to desktop Mac? What do you use?
Well, my current computer is a 2015 MacBook Pro, 16 gigs of RAM, terabyte flash storage. Love this computer. It's amazing. It's got all kinds of ports. It's got HDMI on it. Like, I love it. And I know the future is USB-C, and I'm excited about that too. But, God, I love this computer. It's just so – has everything I need. It's still fast, reliable, great screen.
2015, so you still got the suite of ports instead of USB-C only.
Yeah, and the good keyboard, and you know, I'll probably get another one another year or two, but right now this is just a workhorse of a machine.
Yeah, it is a cool computer. All right, so we really are out of time. I want to thank you from this great tour of Apple and education. Thanks for being my guest on the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you.
Yeah, if I'd love to connect with any listeners. I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y Chambers.
Cool. All right, folks, thank you for joining us. This has been a great show, and if you're interested in Apple and education, I hope you've enjoyed our discussion. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.